on VOA1.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ana Mateo joins us for Words and Their Stories. This week, we discuss a coffee maker that does all sorts of fun things. That is because it's state of the art. Then Kelly Jean Kelly continues our series on America's presidents with Gerald Ford. But first, the Higher Education Report. A recent report shows that the number of international students studying in the United States has returned to pre-pandemic levels. Over 1 million international students attended American colleges and universities in the 2022-2023 school year. Last year's numbers nearly reached the record of 2018. There are fewer Chinese students, but the largest ever number of students from India made up the difference. Almost 269,000 Indian students came to study in the U.S. during the 2022-2023 school year. The number of Chinese students dropped to 290,000, about 90,000 fewer than before the COVID-19 pandemic. Many university leaders are celebrating the growth in students. Kostas Chasapis is one of them. He is the senior vice provost for graduate education at Stevens Institute of Technology in the city of Hoboken, New Jersey. Chasapis said many university administrators are euphoric over the growth of students from India, but he warned that it will not last forever.
The idea that these applications will keep on going up, I have a concern about. You know, that's the euphoria. But I don't have a concern about the continued reasonable increase.
Experts say the increase is partly the result of changes made last year by President Joe Biden's administration to permit more students to qualify for work after graduating. Biden's government increased the number of study programs that qualify for what is known as STEM OPT. STEM stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. OPT is Optional Practical Training. Students who complete a study program at an American university can stay in the U.S. and work for 1 year while on their student visa. However, STEM students are permitted to stay in the U.S. for 2 extra years of OPT. 3 years of OPT, Chasapis said, makes them highly qualified working professionals by the time they are done. A report from the U.S. State Department and the Nonprofit Institute of International Education showed that many students came to the U.S. for math and computer science graduate programs. Those two subjects saw a 20% increase compared to 2021-2022. More than half of all international students in the U.S. are working on degrees in math, science, engineering, or business. Chasapis said international students like Stevens because of its STEM study programs and its location, across the Hudson River from New York City. He added that well over 90% of the school's STEM graduates find work in their field. The increase in international students comes as the number of American students attending college has dropped. A study from the National Student Clearinghouse noted the number of first-year American students decreased by 3.6% this year.
29-year-old Dhruva Rathod of India is working on a graduate degree in human-computer interaction at DePaul University in Chicago. Rathod said he is in a group studying how to make digital three-dimensional images called holograms more interactive with humans. Rathod is from Hyderabad in southern India. He said he came to the United States because India only has space for 50 students each year in the same kind of study program. In the U.S., he estimated, there are 300 to 400 openings for graduate students. Rathod said he considered trying to go to school in the U.S. as long ago as 2015, but he had to give up on the idea because it was too costly. He had degrees in mechanical engineering and industrial design, but he added, in the back of my mind, there was always an option that I should be going for a program abroad in the U.S. or Europe. Rathod said he not only wanted to get into a high-quality study program, but he was looking for a different cultural experience. He wanted to interact with people from all over the world while in the U.S. It took him about 2 years to pass tests, send applications, be accepted, and receive a study permit or visa. Once he arrived in Chicago, he said he was happy with the mix of people. The only thing he does not like is the cold winter weather. The state I come from, he said, is kind of tropical and has sunny and warm weather. If he stays in the U.S. after his study program, he will look for work in warmer places like California or Texas. But he considers his experience in Chicago as an experiment with life. International students make up 5.6% of U.S. college students. University leaders say they support the kind of cultural experience Rathod talked about. In addition, many international students pay the full cost of college, which universities say lowers the cost of college for American students. Rathod said it costs over $31,000 for each year of school at DePaul, including his living expenses. That is after about $6,000 in financial aid. Chasapis in New Jersey said he knows the cost of attending school in the U.S. is a concern for international students. The number of applications to Stevens, though, keeps going up. In 2017, there were 7,000 graduate applications, and last year the number was over 15,000. Chasapis said pent-up demand is one reason for the increase last year. He noted that some countries, such as Australia, did not reopen for international students as quickly as the U.S. He called the increase inflation that will moderate soon. But Stevens is working to remain popular. The school wants to make itself known in places like Indonesia and Vietnam. It is a way of minimizing the risk of depending on one country, which would be India, Chasapis said. Vietnam sends the fifth most students to the U.S., with nearly 22,000. Indonesia sends about 8,000. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and expressions in the English language. We give you definitions, examples, and notes on usage. Sometimes we use them in short conversations. When it comes to learning a language, using words in conversations is not a state-of-the-art learning method. It is a traditional method that has stood the test of time because it works. So, what method would be considered state-of-the-art? Talking with an artificial intelligence robot or using some other cutting-edge computer technology would be considered state-of-the-art. It would be the newest and best available. The phrase state-of-the-art also describes the highest level of development. We can use state-of-the-art to describe advancements in scientific fields. Any major scientific progress can be described as state-of-the-art. State-of-the-art can also be called top of the line or best in its class. We can also say something is the pinnacle of technology or the peak of performance if it is state-of-the-art. Another way to express this thought is to say it is on the forefront of technology, development, or advancement in a particular field. Something that is state-of-the-art is innovative. These terms all have a similar meaning. Something is the latest and greatest. Some word experts say this phrase originated in the early 20th century. It is now very commonly used in both formal and informal situations. Now, let's hear some of these terms used in a conversation between two friends.
Wow, what do you have there?
This is my new coffee machine. It is state of the art.
I can see that. It's really impressive.
It has an on-off setting that I can control from my phone.
You can start your coffee from across town.
Yes, I can. The bean container is split into four parts, so I can have different kinds of coffee.
That is a great innovation.
It gets better. This machine is the pinnacle of coffee technology. Its state-of-the-art technology can also steam milk and add a choice of five different flavorings.
Well, enough talking. Let's have a cup of coffee. I'll take mine with caramel flavor and extra frothy milk.
Yeah. That's going to have to wait for a bit.
Why?
I don't know how to use it yet, but I will after I read this 20-page instruction book.
Got it. I can help, but first, I'll go get us some coffee.
And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Thank you, Anna. I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to the Learning English Podcast. We'll be back with more after this programming message.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Gerald Ford. Ford was the 38th president, but he was never elected to the position. Instead, an unusual series of events brought him there. Many historians have described Ford as a good man facing a difficult situation. He tried to fix a troubled economy, end United States' involvement in Vietnam, and show people that the U.S. government could continue to operate after a crisis. Critics from the two main political parties had problems with Ford's efforts, and voters did not elect him president when they had the chance in 1976. But he is remembered in American history for making many voters feel better about their elected officials. When he was born, the future president was given his father's name, Leslie Lynch King. But the boy's father was abusive. His mother separated from him a short time after their son was born. She asked a court for permission to cancel their marriage. Her request was quickly approved. She and the boy moved from the Midwestern state of Nebraska to Michigan. In a few years, the mother married a man named Gerald Ford. The couple had three sons together. The new family was warm and loving. In time, the oldest boy officially took his stepfather's name and became Gerald Rudolph Ford, Jr. He was called Jerry for short. Growing up, Jerry Ford was a well-liked person and a good student. He was also a top football player. He was named the most valuable player on his team at the University of Michigan. After finishing college, he was offered work with professional football teams. But Ford wanted to continue his education instead. He accepted coaching positions for the football and boxing teams at Yale University in Connecticut. In time, he attended the law school there. Ford's path to politics was similar to that of other presidents during that period. He worked at a law office in his home state. He fought in World War II. He married. Ford's wife was Elizabeth Bloomer. Her friends called her Betty. She had been a dancer and worked as a fashion model. The Fords went on to have four children. When Gerald Ford was 35 years old, he launched his political career. The Republican Party chose him as its candidate for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. Ford was elected to represent his home area of Grand Rapids, Michigan. But unlike many other politicians, he did not move on to the Senate or become governor of a state. Instead, he stayed in the House of Representatives for 25 years. The job of congressman was, in many ways, a good choice for Ford. He was well-liked by many voters and other lawmakers. He could help different groups come to agreement. He took increasingly important positions on political issues, and in time became the top person in his party in the House. Ford was a strong supporter of Republican presidents. In the 1968 election, Ford advocated for Richard Nixon. Ford liked Nixon's plans for the United States, as well as his efforts to improve relations with China and the Soviet Union. Both Ford and Nixon were reelected to their positions in 1972. But by then, major problems had come to light in Nixon's administration. One One problem in the early 1970s related to Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew. Agnew had been vice president since 1969. 5 years later, officials found evidence that he had accepted money from contractors, both while Maryland's governor and as vice president. In answer, Agnew resigned from the presidency. Normally, voters elect a vice president, along with a president, every 4 years. But by coincidence, the U.S. Constitution had recently been updated to say what happens if the country needs a vice president unexpectedly. It states that the president has to nominate someone for the position. Then, a majority of lawmakers in Congress must agree. So, in 1973, Nixon nominated Gerald Ford to take Agnew's position. Nixon was not especially close to Ford, but he knew a majority of lawmakers would likely accept him as vice president. They did. However, Ford did not serve in the position long. In 8 months, another unexpected event put him in the Oval Office. In August 1974, President Richard Nixon resigned from office. He was the first president to do so. As a result, the vice president, Gerald Ford, became president. Ford was sworn in as president on August 9, 1974. Then he spoke to the nation on television. He said, "My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over." He told people, "Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not men." The public had, understandably, lost a good deal of faith in government officials, and especially in Richard Nixon. Ford wanted to reestablish their trust. But a few weeks after taking office, Ford used his presidential powers to pardon Nixon. The pardon meant that Nixon would never face a criminal trial, or, if found guilty, punishment for his actions. Ford said he believed pardoning Nixon would help Americans begin to recover from their painful experience with the former president. But instead, the move angered many people. They believed that Nixon should be held responsible. They also lost some of their trust in Ford. In addition to these political troubles, Ford faced other difficult issues. The American economy was struggling. His administration had to deal with unemployment, inflation, and the lasting effects of an energy crisis. The high price of oil imports came at a time when Americans were using more and more gasoline. Ford took steps aimed at improving the economy, but critics said he was not consistent. Some criticized him for increasing government spending and cutting taxes. Others criticized him for reducing government spending and raising taxes. Ford also oversaw the withdrawal of Americans from Vietnam. An earlier agreement had brought a ceasefire to groups in South Vietnam, North Vietnam, and communist forces. The U.S. officially withdrew its combat troops in 1973, but the fighting restarted. Ford asked Congress to approve military and humanitarian aid for the area. But U.S. lawmakers did not approve the full amount. And in time, they cut military aid. In 1975, communist forces began to take control of Saigon, the capital of South Vietnam. Ford ordered all remaining Americans in the country to leave, along with any South Vietnamese who were connected to the United States. He said that, as far as Americans were concerned, the Vietnam War was finished. Americans did not appear to blame Ford for the troubling end of the country's involvement in Vietnam. And some recognized that the country's economic and energy problems had started long before he became president. But in general, Ford did not have the support of Congress, and many voters did not forgive him for pardoning Nixon. In 1976, Ford officially campaigned for president for the first time. He won his party's nomination in a close race against Ronald Reagan, the former governor of California. But he lost the general election to the Democratic candidate, who said one of his best qualities was that he did not have experience in the federal government. The argument appeared persuasive to many voters, who still did not appear to be enthusiastic about the government. In the 1976 election, nearly half of all people who were legally able to vote chose not to. Ford left the presidency graciously. He said that, because he had not planned to be president, he was thankful for the unexpected opportunity. Although Ford said he was ready to retire from politics, he continued to be active in public life. He advised others on government affairs, published books, and sat on boards and committees. His wife, Betty Ford, also left a lasting effect on the public. As First Lady, she had spoken about her experience with breast cancer. After her husband left the presidency, she also spoke openly about her battle with alcohol and drug abuse. In 1982, Betty Ford co-founded the Betty Ford Center in California to help people get treatment for drug addiction. She announced her husband's death in 2006. Gerald Ford died of heart disease at the age of 93. By that time, most of the public had accepted that one of Ford's biggest achievements was to help the country recover after Nixon resigned. President Bill Clinton gave Ford a Presidential Medal of Freedom for his efforts. And even Jimmy Carter, who beat Ford in the 1976 presidential election, began his inauguration speech by thanking Ford. Carter said, "For myself and for our nation, I want to thank my predecessor for all he has done to heal our land." I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's the Learning English podcast for today. Thank you, Kelly, for that report. And thanks to our VOA colleagues for their work on today's program.
Most importantly, thank you for listening. For more, visit our website at learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedel.